Welcome back to Modern Politics. I'm Warren Balog.
And I'm Emily Yukis.
We're just leaving the first week of December 2024. And, oh man, is there a lot going on. There's so many things. The first thing I want to talk about is right now in the news, Emily, It seems like the Syrian government, Bashar al-Assad, is very besieged. There's all kinds of conflicting reports that Homs has fallen, that Damascus may be falling. Homs is only about, I think, 2 hours road trip to Damascus. So by the time this comes out on Sunday, this show, the picture will be much more clear. It looks like, though, the Syrian government is crumbling, although some of this could just be disinformation.
Yeah, well, let's hope that Assad is okay. Let's hope he gets out of this. I mean, it's crazy. They went after Assad like right after Trump got in the last time they started going after Syria. And it's like Trump's not even in office again, and they're already going back in. So I don't know. This is just a big expansion of Israel here. It's they're going for greater Israel right now on all sides. They're just really going for it. So yeah, it's looking kind of bleak.
Yeah, and this, of course, this whole operation was launched 2 hours after the ceasefire was signed with Lebanon. So obviously this was well in the works for months before that. And the push is, of course, there's multiple things. By breaking up Syria, by destroying Syria, they want to separate Hezbollah's ability to get resupplied and to be backed up by Iran. They, of course, want to take out a major partner of Iran and Russia in the region. They also want to cut off Russia's – this was Russia's big port, I think, into the Mediterranean Sea. So, in other words, these port cities in Syria on the coast there were where Russia had their Mediterranean forces stationed. But it's also to draw forces away for Russia and for Iran from Ukraine.
Right.
And from the other areas that Iran is in, to weaken Iran so that when Trump gets into office, they can just go full tilt against Iran, which that all these signs are that that's going to be the flavor of the new incoming Trump administration. I mean, it's uniformly focused on just destroying Iran, the axis of resistance, breaking it up, and also to force Putin into a much worse negotiating position in Ukraine. In other words, if they are losing their position in the Middle East here, if they're losing all these their allies and their friends, or if they're forced to defend them, then it weakens his ability to make a deal in Ukraine. For the Syrian people, of course, this is horrific. You know, people have said, why is the Syrian army crumbling? Well, the Syrian army, I mean, Syria has been in a state of kind of frozen civil war for years now, where huge parts of the country are not actually controlled by the Syrian government or the Syrian army. I mean, you have the Kurds up in the northeast, which are directly backed by the United States. Then you have this other little pocket in the southeast where the U.S. has their own forces. And then this whole group came out of the so-called, what are they called? The HTS. And it used to be called the Nusra Front. It's the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. I mean, it's actually the former al-Qaeda branch in Syria.
Yeah.
And I want to just mention this guy, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, because I posted on Twitter about this. This guy, CNN, first of all, gave this very, like, just puff piece interview. I mean,
That's
CNN
crazy.
Sits down with this former al-Qaeda guy, an ISIS guy.
A former al-Qaeda guy, 20 years after, you know, going into Iraq and something, to see this guy on television. Usually, you know, it's just really crazy that CNN's puffing him up.
CNN and many others, the New York Times, a lot of these things, they're not like just saying, okay, we support this guy, he's a Democrat, he's a liberal, because they can't. His organization actually is still classified as a terrorist group
Well, you could say liberal democracy is a terrorist ideology, an ideology of terrorism for sure.
But I watched his interview with CNN. Let's just play a clip of that.
you know, listening to you speaking, you've gone through quite the transformation. Once an Al-Qaeda leader, your group has had affiliations with Al-Qaeda, with ISIS, and now you are projecting this image of a moderate leader and a moderate group.
I believe that everyone in life goes through phases and experiences, and these experiences naturally increase a person's awareness. A person in their 20s will have a different personality than someone in their 30s or 40s, and certainly someone in their 50s.
So are those days behind you?
Sometimes it's essential to adjust to reality, and because someone who rigidly clings to certain ideas and principles without flexibility cannot effectively lead societies or navigate complex conflicts like the one happening in Syria.
So they're just throwing these softball questions, being like, huh, you know, do you still want to behead all the infidels? He's like, no, I've matured. I've changed. I've
oh
evolved.
Oh, my God.
So I looked at the history of this guy. He's the same age I am. He was born in 1982. The interesting thing that I saw was that he actually was affiliated not with bin Laden's al-Qaeda, but with the so-called al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was a sort of an independent branch that set up in the aftermath of the Iraq war. And it was led by this guy, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And
these
you said
names are just real mouthfuls here. It's hard to keep them straight. There's like four different Abus.
Well, you weren't really paying that close of attention to the news around 2005-06, right? You were only...
I was 14. I was in middle school. But, I mean, my first animation was about Osama bin Laden and George Bush and Saddam Hussein, Osama Gets Low. So I remember quite, like I didn't know what was going on, obviously. I didn't know, like, the backstory or anything. But, I mean, these figures, Osama bin Laden, Saddam, all that stuff, was constantly, like, being shown to me and in my mind, to the point where I would make like skits about it and animations.
Well, this guy, al-Zarqawi, I want to just mention him because he was big in the news right around 2005, 2006. So the U.S. went into Iraq 2003. Saddam Hussein's government collapsed. It was just overwhelmed and destroyed. But then what emerged around 2004 was a resistance to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And this was a popular resistance, and it was uniting all kinds of disparate groups. I mean, you know, you had people that were former members of the Ba'ath Party and Saddam Hussein's people with other people who were more Islamic-leaning. But there was this kind of unified resistance to the U.S. occupation in Iraq. And then this guy emerged as setting up al-Qaeda in Iraq. I mean, now he declared his allegiance to bin Laden. So in other words, he wasn't sent by bin Laden to Iraq. He emerged in Iraq and said, bin Laden, I pledge myself to you. But then he embarked on this series of terrorist bombings and mass beheadings. And I remember the headlines.
Yeah, he was like bad optics for bin Laden.
Yes, extremely bad optics. I mean, in fact, it's there's no question bin Laden was horrified by this guy's repeated mass killings of civilians. The guy himself, Zarqawi, was a former criminal. He had tattoos. He was, which bin Laden didn't approve of that either.
Yeah. I mean,
he's one of these guys who was like a former scumbag criminal who suddenly discovers his love of like super puritanical Islam.
Yes. Many such cases.
Yes. but he, during that period, became sort of the face of the resistance in Iraq, but actually spent all his time attacking other Iraqis and started this whole Shia-Sunni civil war. And this is, it's now said, he is known as someone, it says it on his Wikipedia, he is known as someone who turned through his bombings and beheadings and attacks. And when I say beheadings, I mean they would find like 50 heads at a time. Like he would do these mass beheadings.
Like literal like 50 beheaded baby type shit.
Yeah, well, yeah. 50 heads. Like yeah. You don't know where the bodies are, but there's 50 heads. They find them in a ditch.
Right.
He did this and then bombing, again, not striking against Israel, not even striking against U.S. troops, but striking against other Iraqis who happen to be of the wrong version of Islam or something like that. Yeah. So this guy, they say he is responsible for turning an insurgency against U.S. troops into a Shia-Sunni civil war. And he is also probably the most bloodthirsty, psychotic, murderous character who emerged during that period. Now, he was killed by the U.S. in 2006, but there was an article that I covered on War Strike that appeared in The Cradle. It was excellent about this guy in March of this year, actually, Emily, that was titled Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, Notorious Terrorist or American Agent. And it went through all the evidence showing how Zarqawi, once a petty criminal turned al-Qaeda leader in Iraq and the U.S. poster child for Takfiri terrorism. He, by the way, his movement inspired ISIS later on. What he did in Iraq inspired ISIS.
Yeah.
But it says that he served as a U.S. intelligence asset tasked with quelling Iraq's resistance to occupation and fanning sectarian hate for the benefit of Tel Aviv and Washington.
Oh, there you go. Ding, ding.
And this article also, it said, by the time of Zarqawi's death, the neoconservative agenda to divide and weaken Iraq through instigating chaos and sectarian conflict had reached its pinnacle. This goal was further exacerbated by the emergence of a successor group to al-Qaeda in Iraq, ISIS, which played an outsized role a few years later in destabilizing neighboring Syria, igniting sectarian tensions there, and providing the justification for the renewal of a U.S. military mandate in Iraq. Now, the reason I'm thinking about this dude is because this guy, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, who people are calling him the Zelensky of Syria, right?
Oh, God,
he even
okay.
wears the same shirt, right?
Okay, yeah.
This guy was in Iraq fighting under Zarqawi at that time. This guy was a part of al-Qaeda in Iraq.
So this guy like glows like a motherfucker.
Not only does he glow, but he was a part of a terror operation in Iraq where there was just mass beheadings and bombings of civilians and also attacking U.S. troops. That's the other thing.
So it's like crazy because it's like for the past year, I mean, ever since Gaza, there's been an extreme anti-Muslim sentiment going on all the mainstream news, both Democrats and Republicans, obviously, because, you know, everyone has to support Israel. Like the sort of mid-2000s thing has come back where it's like acceptable to be racist against Muslims and everything. The mid-2000s are really back in many ways. But now, even after all that, now they're pulling out this like radical Islamist and like promoting him on CNN, just like, and we're just supposed to accept it. Like, okay, now we're going to think that this guy's the good guy or something because he's trying to take out a secular Assad. I mean, it just, yeah.
Well, there's headlines saying that he's going to be, we're not like the old al-Qaeda. You know, I've reformed and we're not going to persecute people. There's going to be a diversity. There was this article, how serious diversity friendly jihadists plan on building a state. This is from the Telegraph. Yeah. And
how do they expect people to just be like, okay, all right, this all makes sense. The diverse radical Islamists.
Yeah. But
I mean,
not only are these people like murderous religious fanatic psychos, they have the blood already of so many innocent Muslims on their hands. And these are the people that we supposedly fought the war in Afghanistan and Iraq to oust. You know,
they flip-flop. It's like, okay, we're going to go after them, but when they're useful, we're going to use them and make them into our tool.
Well, the most amazing thing, Emily, is that al-Qaeda wasn't in Iraq when we attacked Iraq because of their connections to al-Qaeda. They were in Iraq after we toppled the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein, the secular, also a Baathist, just like Assad and the Syrian Baath Party. So
these are just destabilizing agents.
Yes.
That are used to topple like stable and secular regimes.
Yes.
Like Assad is actually, you would think, would be the guy that they'd be putting on CNN, like, this is the guy that's bringing, like, you know, a liberal democracy side to the Middle East.
Yeah, he's a doctor. I mean, with the policies with women, they always talk about the women. I mean,
yeah. Look at him. He's like he would be what you would think that, like, Biden and everyone would say, oh, this is a good leader. This is the one good leader in the Middle East. But no, he's got to go. And it's because he's a good leader and it's because Israel wants to get rid of him.
Yes. And all the shilling against Assad and against his government. I mean, This country, Syria, has been under the most intense sanctions. They are regularly hit with missile strikes. And as I said, they haven't been in control of their country. So they've been in an incredibly weakened position for them to launch this thing. But it doesn't look good right now. And all of this is to try to destabilize Syria and weaken Hezbollah's ability to rearm itself so Israel can just go ape.
They just want greater Israel. I mean, yes. They want to expand in all directions. Like, this is the biblical prophecy must happen now. The Trump's in the White House and the heifers and the temple and blah, blah, blah. The Jewish kooky crap, you know, they think they're going to, like, manifest now for divine providence or something.
Right. So this is all very, very bad. And it just shows that the Zog still has the ability to strike and to strike back. It has a lot of options, you know. So they were able to, in Lebanon, they were able to kill Nasrallah and decapitate the whole leadership of Hezbollah with these assassinations. In Iran, they were able to kill probably the president and the foreign minister, although that has not been publicly acknowledged, but I think that's what happened. And then they were able to kill the leader of the Palestinians, Ismail Haniyeh, inside Tehran, which shows that there are traitors and there are sellouts. Of course, Erdogan in Turkey is the big sellout and the big traitor here because he's the one that has been backing this group. But
then they got Yahya Sinwar, and now they're going after Assad. So it's kind of like the end of the Godfather moment here.
They're trying to
take them all out.
Yeah, all the people who have been the pillars of opposition to Israel for two decades or more in the Middle East. They're trying to wipe them all out. And the big one that they're going to go for, the checkmate piece, is Iran. And this is a very, very dangerous time because, you know, Iran and Russia are not going to go quietly. And of course, China is in the background with all this. So with this group of psychos now set to enter the White House, I don't foresee this entering into a new stable period where it's just some kind of like, okay, nothing ever happens and things are calm and I think things are going to continue to escalate.
Yeah. Trump is going to be the guy that like reignites the Middle East. They're going to he's going to go hard for the Jews.
I mean, his whether he wants to or not, all the people that are being put in place by Miriam Adelson and by these Zionists, that's the direction they're going to take it. So this is a very, very dangerous time, and this is not good, this whole development. But yeah, I just wanted to point that out, that this guy, al-Jolani, is just a disciple of al-Zarqawi in Iraq, who was the worst, you know, so-called al-Qaeda mass murderer of that entire period, and was used as a U.S. tool to destabilize and turn that into this bloody civil war. That's the other thing, is that what is going to happen to Syria here is not a nice new stable democracy forms. What's going to happen to Syria here is Libya.
Yeah, exactly.
Libya
that's
is
always
gonna,
that's yes. what liberal democracy really is all about.
Destroying.
Yes.
And so we'll see what happens. But something happened, though, also since we did our last show, and this is the main thing we want to talk about, that has spooked a lot of the plutocrats and others here at home.
Yeah.
And that is United Healthcare, which is the largest health insurance company in the United States. It's actually the ninth largest company, I think, in the world or in the United States at least. Their CEO, a guy named Brian Thompson, was in New York in Manhattan for a conference. And a masked assassin came up behind him and gunned him down. Apparently, he used some kind of World War II era technology, this gun that has like a silencer built into it, shot the guy three or four times. And as of the time we are recording this, he is still at large. They think he has slipped completely out of New York.
Wow.
And it's not even clear whether or not the pictures of this guy smiling. I think people have been saying that the backpack isn't the same. It's not the same guy. Like the pockets, there's details on his jacket and his backpack is not the same color as the other guy in the picture. So I think those pictures probably, again, by the time this comes out, they may have already stopped using those photos. But they're looking for this guy.
There's also theories he might have been wearing like a mask, like one of these realistic face masks. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
I think he's gotten away. Like,
it seems like he slipped out. And this has really, really scared them because, you know, this country, what's the Sam Hyde quote about how this world is not dying, it's being destroyed, and the people destroying it have names and addresses? I think that's sort of what is happening here.
Yes.
I mean, we've seen an enormous use of assassination in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Trump, there were two assassination attempts on Trump. The entire modus operandi of Israel has been to assassinate leaders. And the reason you don't generally do that in wartime is because if you start assassinating people, it opens you up to assassination.
Right.
And I think what this targeted killing of this healthcare CEO right in Manhattan, why this has all the elite so spooked, is because it's a reminder that they also can be assassinated, that these people also, you know, the people who actually run this country and run this world, who are billionaires and such, they are vulnerable to being killed. They're human.
Yeah, yeah. And they try and make them out to be the faceless elite, this, like, you know, unknown cabal of billionaires. Well, like you said, they are real people. They do exist in the physical world, and theoretically they can be accessed by the public.
Yes. And so there's a couple of aspects to this assassination that I want to talk about. So in the first place, the reaction to this has been amazing. The public, there's been an enormous outpouring from the public of rage against health insurance companies. Now, we have a horrible healthcare system in this country in terms of the way it works, the for-profit healthcare system, as they say.
It's like the worst in the world. I think we're the only developed rich country that doesn't have universal healthcare. That's kind of hard to fathom anything else as an American.
Yeah.
Like in other countries, you can just go in, like, you know, you get in a car crash. Oh, you just go in. You don't have to worry about the cost of the ambulance. You don't have to worry about being saddled with bills. And then you leave. And, you know,
we have the best medical technology and we have some of the best doctors and healers. But the problem is there's this huge capitalist apparatus, this giant for-profit scam. And a lot of behind it stands ultimately, you know, one of the biggest shareholders of United is like BlackRock and Vanguard.
Right.
We don't really need to get into all the details of why this healthcare system is so bad, but basically a for-profit healthcare system with this massive layer of insurance people and administrative costs and all this means that the United States healthcare system is not really about healing people or about health. It's about money. It's about profit.
Yes.
And the worst profiteers of all are the insurance companies like United. United is one of the worst. They have there are all kinds of lawsuits, all kinds of terrible things they've done. The biggest thing is how they have to fight to deny care, to deny coverage to people. I mean, you think about this racket.
It's part of the business to deny people coverage.
The racket, you pay into the insurance company, and the only way they make a profit is if they pay out less than people are paying in. That's by its nature, that's the only way they make a profit.
Yeah.
So they are incentivized to fight your insurance claims, to charge as much as possible and make you pay as much as possible after you're already paying.
Right.
You pay your copay, your deductibles and all this. But then on top of that, when you have to make a claim, to fight that and say, well, this isn't medically necessary, or go to this provider because we have a deal with them. You can't use this provider. You don't need this treatment, etc.
And so it's like, it's so bizarre to me that you're like, you're paying for a service that you then, you're shelling out a lot of money for a service that you then have to fight to even use.
Yeah.
And go through like insane, like bureaucracy, headaches, etc. You know? It's just on every level. It's so screwed up.
We'll go through a couple of headlines here. Just full disclosure, neither you or I have health insurance. And also, I have very little experience dealing with this system. I've only ever had health insurance when I have it through my employer, as a lot of people do.
Yeah. And we're self-employed now, so.
Yeah.
So what do we do for health insurance? I don't know, just don't get sick.
Right, don't get sick.
That's been the strategy.
That is the strategy.
It's working.
But I think for a lot of people, I've never had to use it through my employer. You know, thank goodness I've never had a major illness where I needed to use it when I had it through my employer. So I have no experience dealing with this system myself. But you talk to anybody, any one of these posts, any one of these articles or on social media, and it seems like everybody has a horror story. Everyone knows someone in their family. I'm sure the subscribers to this show have lots of horror stories of dealing with these companies.
Yeah, and if you have any, please post them in the comments.
Yeah, but the thing is, this guy was a multi-millionaire.
Profiting off of this.
Profiting off of this horrible thing that doesn't actually help with healing people. It's just sucking blood through this elaborate, bizarre, upside-down system that we have.
Yeah. So what did you compared it to, like, the mob, like the insurance company?
It is the mob.
Acts
yeah. Protection racket. It's a protection racket, and that's what it is. You know, the whole thing, idea of them negotiating better prices, it's all a big protection racket.
So it's like, I don't want to get screwed over by the hospital, so I'm going to pay a ton of money to this thing that's supposedly going to stop me from having to pay a ton of bills, but I'm still going to have to pay a ton of bills and there's no guaranteed protection and I have to fight with them.
Yeah.
I mean, what the fuck?
I mean, we see constantly the issue of people being, you know, denied at first for critical care, and then time goes by where it makes a difference, like with cancer. Crucial time period goes by before you get approved, and then by the time you get approved, the cancer has metastasized or is some new horrible condition. I mean, there's so many different examples, so many different ways that this insurance industry screws people over. So the question of, was it moral for this guy to be assassinated? I mean, we can sort of put that to one side. You know, it was certainly illegal. It's against the law. I would say that in a absolute moral sense, people like this who are filthy, filthy, filthy rich off of this horrible industry, this horrible business, are deeply immoral people. And yeah. The fact that he has, you know, a wife and kids that mourn him, I mean, and so does Benjamin Netanyahu. Like, that yeah. means nothing
and
to
so
me.
And so do, you know, how many people die that had wife and kids because of these policies. You know, he's literally getting filthy rich off of the suffering and deaths of everyday of regular Americans.
Right. And these people are, there's so many people like this walking around in our society, bankers, all kinds of people who profit off ruining people's lives, I mean, off destroying yeah. people's lives. This entire system,
this whole
it's a plutocracy.
Yeah,
yes,
it's a plutocracy. This whole country, the way to get rich is to screw over other people. That's
yes.
basically the only way you're going. People are like, oh, he was just successful. Don't be mad at someone who's successful. I mean, when you're in that income level, when you're in that income bracket, yeah, his net worth was about $43 million. I mean, once you get into that income bracket, it's like. I mean,
yeah, you think they're paying him that to you know, spend money on sick people? Like, that's not what the health insurance companies do. So, you know, I mean, I'll just say, screw this guy. I don't care. Screw this guy. Like, somebody like this is a complete scum. And, you know, people in our thing have also pointed out how United is, of course, on the side of all kinds of woke stuff. With diversity, with the trans stuff,
oh,
and everything
yeah,
else.
Yeah.
I mean, people like this. Oh, he was white. I mean, so what?
Yeah, who cares? Like, I mean, like, so I said on Twitter, a white traitor who profits off of, like, killing his own people, basically, is, like, the worst thing of all. That's worse than a Jew.
Yeah, I think the whole plutocrat class of this country are just awful, awful people. And it's no loss to humanity when one of them is no longer with us. So I will just leave it at that. So there's that question. Now, the right-wing reaction to it, we'll talk about that in a second, because this is where it really gets – we really get down to the ideological meat of this. But just on the issue of vigilantism, though, I want to point this out, that I feel like this is part of what Stryker calls the post-populist moment. I mean, it's an inevitability, I think, in a country where people are, first of all, as well-armed as Americans are, but in a country where people's lives just get lousier and lousier and lousier, you know, overwhelmed by migrants and immigrants. We have out-of-control black crime, Hispanic crime. You know, and then now the introduction of all kinds of like Pajit scammers, scamming like old people.
Yeah. I mean, the housing market.
Like, we have,
child care costs.
I mean, inflation. We have the situation where now, you know, AI is being used in ways by corporations to micromanage people's time, to like manage people.
People are treated like drones. They don't, I mean, like when you see them, like the average person, how they're like just worked to death, no vacation days, no sick days. I mean, you have to play these games like, oh, if you get too sick, you got to use your vacation days. I mean,
people can't see buy a house.
Yeah. They, it's not so much that the inflation is like on Iran level or like that bad, but it's more about how much people have to work to be able to live. And then they are barely living. I mean, the amount of hours people are run freaking down to like drone status. I mean, you see your kids for like an hour after daycare, you're running around. If you get sick, screw you. I mean, well, and it's just making people sicker.
The leading cause of bankruptcy in America is apparently medical bills. You have this situation where everybody's lives are getting worse and worse and worse slowly, particularly white people. And then you have this plutocrat class, some of which is Jewish. It's all Jewish in spirit. And, of course, Jews are the ones dominating and ultimately steering the system. And the white traitors that fill the ranks of the plutocrat class and their immediate underlings are all taking their lead and their inspiration from the Jews who actually run this system, like right. The Larry Finks of this world.
Yeah.
But this class of people are just – their wealth has been taking off like to the moon. In the last 25 years, these people have gotten richer and richer and richer and richer. And how they do it, if you just study the history of where United comes from, we won't get into it now, but the story of how United came to be the largest health insurer in the country, how they expanded and how, you know, the whole thing with HMOs and all that, it's just one disgusting cutthroat practice after another.
Yeah.
And you have this type of monopoly, this vertical integration, they call it, where they have their hooks in like basically every part of the process. Like for instance, the staffing organizations at hospitals, every single part of the process they're involved in. And it's just this giant monopoly. This is Peter Thiel's whole thing is that's the best way to get rich is to have a monopoly. So, yeah. In a runaway crazy plutocracy where we have this billionaire elite emerging that, as I've said many times, they live sort of like gods over the rest of us. And everyone else is suffering. And these people get finally to the point where they have nothing else to live for and their lives have been destroyed and they can't form a family and they can't buy a house and they have weapons available. And by the way, you can outlaw all the guns. Just get rid of the Second Amendment and get rid of all the guns, and people still have knives, people still have cars that they can crash into things. But if you do this, you press these people down, this other class just gets richer and richer and richer. It is inevitable. It is inevitable that sooner or later, some vigilantes are going to start to take the fight to the people causing their pain.
Right. And, you know, we're not endorsing it, but certainly a step up from just random mass shootings of random innocent people. I mean, that's just retarded. That's not going to achieve anything. What I'm saying is, like, is it a bad thing if some of these people that are like actively destroying the country and just getting filthy rich off of like, you know, ruining average Americans, if they have like a little bit of fear in the back of their mind when they walk down the street? Is that like the end of the world?
Well, this is the thing. There's no way to hold them accountable. This is the problem that people have.
They made it so there's no way in this country to hold these people accountable.
See, this is the thing. The old libertarian take is, and I said this on Twitter, vote with your wallet. Well, the problem with voting with your wallet is when your wallet is this big and the wallet of the people you're competing against is bigger than the universe, There's no, you have no ability to influence their decisions. I mean, they can just squeeze you out, crush you, buy you off, buy off your competitors or whatever every single time. So that's,
yes.
And that's what, you know, the basis of unions, collective bargaining. The idea of collective bargaining is that each individual worker does not have the money power of the CEO or of the owners of the company, the stockholders or something. So if you get all those people together, though, and they all pool their money together, then they collectively have enough resources, or they have the ability to do a work stoppage or something like that, where now they can sit down at the bargaining table with the owners of the company and they can actually demand terms. The problem in America is this is just not something that people have anymore. I mean, unions don't really have the strength they once did. That's brought in.
Yeah, the diversity.
The outsourcing.
People don't have time to organize. Like, they are so run down and so worked to death that they don't have time to organize or think about anything other than just basic survival.
Yes. And then you say, well, okay, well, then don't vote with your wallet. Vote with your actual vote. Go in the ballot box and vote for what you want. Well, the problem is, I'll give you one example, Emily. I mean, the Trump administration is populist. You know, this, we heard it in Madison Square Garden. So all these people railing against how it's a, you know, we're the little people, you know, Giuliani.
We're the little people, populism, voting in billionaires.
And look at the amount of billionaires. Here's a list of the billionaires that Trump has appointed to his administration. There are more billionaires in Trump's administration incoming that he wants than any administration to date. So it's just openly billionaires running the country.
Yeah, and well, Kamala also had her share of billionaires.
Oh, she had more billionaires backing her. Yes. So
there's just billionaires controlling everything.
Yes, and they will do what they want to do. The same way that they will do that on foreign policy, they will do what they want to do with the economy.
And there's third parties are just snuffed out. I mean, the third party, like, they're never going to win. I mean, the idea of democracy, it's all a sham. The two-party system is a sham. The system is just rigged in every way possible.
And people are willing to put up with that. There's all kinds of people in the world, like the people in Saudi Arabia, for instance, who live under oppressive regimes where it's this corrupt ruling elite run everything. And no one can overthrow that. The thing is, though, that will hold as long as you aren't completely destroying people's lives. But when you start just really messing with people and crushing them and destroying their lives, I mean, we've always had an oligarchic elite in America. It's a capitalist country. But when there was still a chance where you could actually own a house or have a family or live a normal, you know, lower middle class life. When that is taken away and then you torture people with the health care and you put them through these horrible hoops to just get what they've been paying into, when you destroy people that completely, eventually there's going to be resistance. And that's what this is an example of. But let's talk just for a second about the reaction to this.
Yeah.
Here are a couple of headlines. So this was the first one I saw. Axios: United Health CEO's killing unleashes social media rage against insurers.
Yeah, oh, I've been seeing it.
It says that posters lashing out over coverage denials and other business practices. Experts say the lack of sympathy may reflect an inherent truth about Americans and their health plans.
I mean, the left is out of control right now. I mean, they are Fed posting. I mean, I'm over on Blue Ski, I call it now, Blue Sky. They are Fed posting like hell over there, and they're getting away with it. It's so funny because Blue Ski, you know, is like the leftist gab. But it's like, even on there, you're getting people like just straight up saying, yes, let's assassinate these people. This was a good thing. Let's assassinate the billionaires. You know, the healthcare system sucks. It's so funny how the issue of healthcare is suddenly back, because we haven't heard much about it since like 2015,
yeah,
like before all the race and DEI and woke stuff just completely took over all like the rational, like, you know, things that the left was fighting for, like healthcare and wages and stuff. Now it's back. It's back in full force because of this issue. I mean,
We're not saying that. Like, what are people to take away from this other than that violence is the only thing that gets results? Again, I'm not saying that. I'm saying when nothing fixes the system And then some guy kills a CEO, and all of a sudden they're talking about this. I mean, I saw on Twitter a guy complaining about Cigna Health and some horror story. And then, of course, Cigna, you know, it's probably a bot, automatically replies and says, please reach out to us. They're taking down all the pictures right now of their CEOs.
Oh,
they're,
yeah.
They're revising the, you know, the biographies and everything.
They're
trying to delete their Wikipedia pages.
Yeah.
But again, how do you hold these companies accountable if something like this happens, and especially if this guy gets away with it, which you better believe the system is going after this guy like nothing you've ever seen.
It's the majority of people that I'm seeing think that this guy didn't do anything wrong. So I don't, you know, people aren't going to really be itching to rat out this guy.
Well, here's the thing. If this guy is caught, I mean, it shows the limits, just like October 7th, it shows the limits of the surveillance state. I mean, Manhattan is the most controlled, policed, surveilled patch of real estate on earth.
Right.
And it's the most, because it's the most elite. I mean, you have people walking around in Manhattan and have apartments.
That's all the it's the Jewish ruling class.
It's the global ruling elite. Yeah. London and New York City are where they are headquartered.
And Tel Aviv.
And for this guy to do this is so brazen right under their noses. If he gets away with it, it's going to be very bad. It's going to set a very bad precedent. So you better believe they are, and I've seen this, they are going to review every minute of footage from every camera within miles of this, the feds are going to do to try to find. Meanwhile, an average white person gets, you know, a hit and run. Some black person kills somebody. Nobody cares.
Yeah, no
one
cares.
Nobody cares.
But it's like, you know, the movie The Fugitive. The more time goes on, the less likely they're going to find this guy. And time's a ticking. And well, they got nothing.
The biggest threat to this person being caught is not the surveillance technology, it is snitches. It is that some goody-goody is going to snitch on him. You know, someone will recognize him. Now, again, if that face in the picture is not actually him, then that will help. But if it is him, then people are going to – somebody is going to rat him out. Now, though, the culture in the country will be such that whoever is the rat would get such public hate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he's going to be at risk. It seems like the far left and the far right are just uniting on this issue. The only people that are saying, let's hold this guy accountable, are like the center right and the center left.
Well, not so. The far right, there's plenty of people on the so-called far right who have pushed back on this.
Yeah, I don't know what you would call them. Yeah, so it seems like the right and the left are united in a lot of ways, but there are still people that are like on the right that are like, hey, we shouldn't just go around shooting people. And I mean, we're not saying that either. But I mean, we're not also not going to counter signal it online, right?
Well, the people that are saying, oh, this is terrible that this happened. And this is, first of all, there's a lot of right wingers that have been saying this, that have been pushing back on this. And one of the takes that I've seen is trying to tie this to the Daniel Penny trial and say, oh, see, just like Daniel Penny, it's because he's a white man in the left. Matt Walsh is the worst.
But that
absolute
is like the most
scum.
There's no parallel. The more parallel would be that, okay, these are both scumbag criminals that got vigilante justice. Wouldn't that be the parallel? I mean, that's what I say.
Well, in the Daniel Penny thing right now, you know, the jury is out on it. They did some kind of weird move. Chris Manahan from Information Liberation had a great article about this, how they're trying to downgrade, swap out the charges so they can still get a conviction, which is totally unorthodox. This horrible, horrible Jew prosecutor is doing this. But the thing about Daniel Penny is the system right now, I would say the majority of the system wants him to get off because he is a poster child for, you know, the Marines, joining the Marines. Like
it's the Trump era, baby.
Right.
Like,
their priorities have shifted.
Let's give the white man a bone. Let's
and
throw him
of course,
bone.
We've covered, when we did a whole episode on Daniel Penny, and we hope that he does get off. But the point is, their strategic shift on this. Now we want the white Marine to go free, and now we're all anti-woke.
So he can go fight for Israel.
Right. So guys like that, we don't want to disincentive guys like that and make them think that the system is against them. Now, what I've been saying is, let's see what happens in the Andrew Lester case, the old man who shot the black kid that he thought was homebreaking. We also covered that on the issue.
Oh, my God. Yeah, what happened?
That trial is set to begin.
Wow.
And we'll see, because all the online right spaces, will these people defend him the way they defended Daniel Penny? Now, of course, they won't. One, because he is not a physically attractive man, and these people are all homos. The you know, Baptist right or whatever, all the Zio right are homosexuals.
But beyond that,
well, okay, let's say sodomites. Beyond that, though, they are also, it doesn't fit in, because defending an old man like that is not something that they're really interested in, because they don't need old men to sign up and join the military. And the whole Pete Hegseth thing, they want guys to join the military.
Yeah, that story did get memory hold, and I think they're going to try and continue to just, like, quietly sweep it under the rug and jail this old man until he dies.
Why not talk about pardoning the McMichaels? Why not talk about pardoning all the other people? You know, why not pardon Ian Cranston? I mean, this is who Trump should pardon when he comes into office. I mean, because these people were just as unjustly prosecuted as Daniel Penny.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just, he's like the poster boy. He's like the white guy du jour, you know. I mean, this is what, you know, people can only focus so much on one thing.
But you have people, like I said, Matt Walsh, who is one of the worst scumbags, pretends to be like with us on certain things. It's totally coming out and condemning this shooting in a very performative way, doing that for his masters. And then you have Patrick Casey, who is one of the worst little scumbag traitors that our movement has produced in the last 10 years, who is very vocally coming out and condemning this and saying this is because the left hates white men. It hates white people.
Oh, come
fellow
on.
White
oh,
people.
Jesus.
Suddenly, Brian Thompson, we're supposed to think about racial solidarity. Did he think about racial solidarity with us?
No.
Do these plutocrats think, do they think of us when they see dying and sick white people all over the country?
No, he thinks of dollar signs when he sees dying and sick.
Oh, these are my fellow people. You know, well, then why should we care when one of them gets bumped off and then leftists so-called online are saying, oh, yeah, good. Why should we be like, oh, he was a white man. We must stand up for the white race.
Oh, because we don't want to agree with the left. We don't want to be leftist. But you know what? The Patrick Casey, then that position, there are leftists agreeing with that position. They're just like the gayest, worst leftists, like the center left. Like,
yes.
Yes. Like, so they're having the exact same takes as Will Stancil.
They're the ones paid by Jews also. I mean, well, John Fetterman, look at this huge headline of Fetterman condemning this and saying how far it's gone. Now, Fetterman takes more money from Jews and is more center left. He's the new center left thing that they want to do.
Oh, the center left. Yeah. Well, it's very conspicuous because, you know, Stancil will never mention Gaza. He calls Hamas terrorists. He claims to be a big bleeding heart that cries for the blacks, yet he won't mention Palestine. I mean, he's being influenced or paid by Jews, guaranteed. But I mean, he's out there saying, first of all, that this is really bad, but also that the healthcare system's great and the economy's great. So you've got a class of people, these center leftists, that are like, actually, the healthcare system's really good, and they're going to pull out like one or two charts, and they're saying, well, then that's it. End of story. The healthcare system's great. People love their health insurance. The economy's great. Everyone's richer than ever. You're not suffering. Shut up. Stop whining. Populism is the greatest evil. I mean, I don't know. Do you see anyone else doing this?
This is the standard. Well, people are not, or they're even afraid to say it because they get attacked so much because there's so many victims of this healthcare system online just raging against anyone who expresses this opinion.
Well, he's getting a lot of like death threats.
But I also want to talk about Nick Fuentes. I mean, his take on this was terrible. And it just shows that Fuentes at heart, you know, he's in jail right now, but he's someone who at heart,
Is he in jail or did he get let out?
I don't know if he's out on bail or whatever. He was arrested. That's irrelevant. The point is, he is someone who comes from a privileged background, lives in a privileged area, has no interest in the workers. I mean, he totally subscribes to this right-wing elite theory that we need to have, you know, get rich people backing us and curry favor with rich people.
I mean, it's good to, you know, get money and stuff, but, you know, that's a different issue.
But it's the same root cause of why he condemned Patriot Front and made fun of Patriot Front. This guy has no sense. I mean, Trump, I will say, has more of sense for the workers, working people, more respect for him. The problem with people like Nick Fuentes in this case, their instincts on this, is it shows that they are still fundamentally right-wingers when this is not actually about right versus left. So this whole reaction of right, so-called right-wingers to this, where they feel the need to publicly come out and signal against this, all right, which was really an act of vigilante justice. And we know it was because the killer had on the bullet casings, he had these three words, deny, defend, and depose, which were written on the shell casings. There was actually a book written about this, why insurance companies don't pay claims and what you can do about it. The whole idea is deny the claim, then defend it in court, and then depose the person, I think. So you just create so many headaches so people won't even bother to fight when you deny their claim. Like, right. Basically, it's just
strategy. Like anarcho-tyranny. It's like,
totally.
You don't know, like, what, like, okay, if I fight with this guy, like, one more month, like, 7 months instead of six, will it finally work? There are people that have said that. They're like, finally, on the seventh month, they accepted my claim.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, like, after 6 months of, like, pain and suffering about this stuff. But, yeah, I mean, look, it's just a bad take. It's a bad take.
It separates out people who are essentially national socialists from reactionaries.
Right.
Reactionaries, their instinct is,
oh, the left is a fan of this, then I cannot be a fan.
Yes, yeah, and that sort of
thinking. You don't want to be a leftist, do you?
Right.
I mean, come on, aren't you confident in your racism? I am confident enough in my racism and my anti-Semitism that I'm not going to be scared of agreeing with a leftist on something.
Well, I mean,
we're national socialists. I mean,
yeah.
That's in the name. Yeah, a lot of the people are not, wouldn't consider themselves to be national socialists. But, you know, we are against the
capitalist system.
Yeah, we're against the capitalist system.
The corrupt plutocracy has got to go. And in fact, the white traitors that fill out the ranks of this predatory plutocracy do more really to harm our people than anybody, and they're worse for it because they're traitors. So this was an act of vigilante justice, and for somebody to go out there and signal against it like that, it's one of two things. Either you are directly paid by plutocrats, and I think in the case of many of these people, they are people who directly get money from Peter Thiel or people like Peter Thiel. And I even think in some ways, in some of these cases, there was even a directive that went out that,
oh,
hey, herd your people away from this. So they're either paid by Peter Thiel, they're either getting money directly from plutocrats, and so this is what they have. They can't go against their bosses, right? Or they are people who their instincts, even though they say they are nationalists or they say they are racialists or they're right-wingers, their instincts are still fundamentally libertarian conservative instincts.
Yeah,
and,
which sucks. But none of these people are anywhere near the income bracket of the CEO or anyone who actually controls the system. So yeah, they may come from like more privileged backgrounds, but they're still in the same like category as like the plebs, the lower crust. Like, they're not doing yourself any favors by like defending billionaires and like multi-millionaires. Like, it's not, I mean, you are not in that level. Like, you are not part of that class. Like, none of these people defending them are anywhere near that stratosphere class. Like, you know, you have more in common with like poor wage slaves at Walmart than you do with these multi-millionaires and billionaires. So it's like, why defend them? That's not you. Like, you have nothing to do with
them. They're defending them because they want to curry favor with them.
Well,
they
you're not going
grovel
to.
To them.
You're not going to curry any favor. They view you just as much as they have view you with as much disdain as the average like McDonald's wage slave.
The interesting thing about this is just that the right now, I feel, is retarded and stupid and dead with Trump's victory.
Oh, that's
and
been
we're
so going to
see stuff on the left that's going to get very, very interesting right now, at least until the Democrats regroup and they get their act together in some form. But the idea that this is a direction that the left is going to go, because the left is very excited about this, what happened, and is very excited about the sort of popular rage against the insurance companies, which is good. Anybody that's pro-white should feel the same way. Hopefully this type of populist rage against these capitalists that we see expressed by all the people that feel like it's okay now to vent about what's being done to them. Hopefully we will see more of that in the next few months and years. I want to see people feel like it's okay to talk about how the system is screwing you over.
Yes,
and
let's
this
get
killing
back
has
to,
opened the floodgates.
Let's get back to health care. Let's get back to like Occupy Wall Street type stuff. Let's get back to the real issues that the left and the right can kind of unite over, which is why they tried to like break up Occupy Wall Street so much and then try and like, you know, make everything all about race and class. And it is ultimately about race. But
it's about race. I mean, the other one I saw, Jeremy Carl, who wrote The Unprotected Class. I mean, he's a Jew, and I saw him leaping on the same thing. And I just see them doing this. All the Jews and gatekeepers like that, that are suddenly the new like kosher pro-white, trying to divert the thing away. And in the same way, to bring this back around to where we started the show, al-Zarqawi in Iraq did the same thing in terms of there was a popular resistance to the U.S. occupation of Iraq, and it got turned by this guy and by what was going on there into a civil war where Sunnis are fighting Shiites. So if you look at, in America, this type of thing, a healthcare executive, a health insurance executive, absolutely despised by all people on the right and the left, and rightly so. You have the Matt Walshes and the Patrick Caseys and the Jeremy Carls swooping in to say, oh, it's the left. The left is, this is a leftist thing. They don't like this guy. And I've seen this take even from people who should know better.
Yeah.
The only reason the left is celebrating this is because he's white.
And
that's actually to start the whole thing. Because once you make it into one of these gay left versus right fights, then it becomes about just owning the other. And that's what Nick Fuentes is playing right into. It's just owning the other side. You're taking your position because those people are taking the opposite position.
Right.
Instead of saying, what are white people? What are our interests? And if we got to go to the far left in one case or the far right in another case, we're going to do what's in the interests of our people and against the people who are hurting our people. That's the only value. Aryans versus Jews and versus white traitors. Like, that has to be the value system, not this whole left-right dynamic. So,
yeah. Well, they're just afraid of populism in general. I mean, I'm going to call them the center-right. The center-right and the center-left are both afraid of populism. On both the left and the right, they hate it. They're scared of it. They don't like it because they're system enjoyers, and they want to fundamentally just preserve the system. But the system is anti-white. The system is like actively trying to kill white people and replace them in every single way. So I just don't see why anyone wants to defend and uphold the system.
Yes. So we'll see. Israel is having big wins right now in Syria. Globally, the ceasefire in Lebanon and then the whole push here in Syria has actually put Russia and China and Iran, I think the strategic initiative right now is being taken by Zog. But this assassination that happened in New York City has them very scared because it just shows that they don't have their own people in their own countries as locked down as they think they do. And that sometimes, you know, things lead to unintended consequences. Sometimes resistance takes on even more dangerous forms when you tamp down it in other ways. So, again, it's been an interesting week. I think everything that we see right now is a sign of times to come, for better or for worse.